Constant Wonder began as a radio show, and for the past 4 years, Constant Wonder has also been a podcast. For everyone on our production team, it has been deeply gratifying to welcome newcomers to our audience, which is growing day by day. Growing in numbers, to be sure, but also in appreciation of our aim. We are struck by how quickly folks resonate with our guests' stories about transformative experiences of awe and wonder. This feeling of awe is a universal across all places, across all populations, the world around. We're just starting out with a fresh podcast season, so we've decided for the episode you're about to hear to present something inspirational for newcomers and longtime listeners alike. Even if you've been listening to Constant Wonder for a year or two, earlier on in our life as a podcast, we featured some true gems you are likely to have missed. So you're about to hear from three of these early guests: a biogeochemist who studies biocrusts, a medical ethnobotanist who finds medicines in plants, a nature writer who celebrates our connections to the world around us. So please enjoy Constant Wonder throughout the year 2026, and also these three unforgettable, wonderstruck guests in this sampler from our archive. Let's start with Sasha Reed, a biogeochemist and ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Moab, Utah. This excerpt from my visit with Sasha Reed spotlights the backstory of how and why she found her way to the outdoors and eventually became captivated with cryptogamic soils or biocrusts. These biocrusts are often described as the living skin of the earth and consist of communities of living organisms that can be found in arid and semi-arid ecosystems inhabiting the soil surface. I happen to know that you didn't go camping as a kid and you'd never been camping till you came out west. Where did you first go camping, and did you, on that occasion, have any understanding of just how rich and abundant the life forms are in a place like the Intermountain Desert West?
The first place I went camping was outside of Phoenix, so it was a desert. I had not been camping before. I was terrified about the idea of sleeping with only a thin piece of fabric between me and all of the things that certainly wanted to kill me in the desert night, all the sounds and the small chirps and the creaks.
Was there elbow twisting involved to get you there?
So I was going to visit my boyfriend, now my husband, and he is an avid camper. And I hadn't agreed to go camping. He was going to college out west. I was in college in New York. And I came out to visit him, and he picked me up at the Phoenix airport. And he let me know then that we were going camping. And it was in a desert. And I was really nervous, but probably trying to play it pretty cool. And then the stars came out, and they were bright. The sky, not having very much moisture, really let me see a whole new side of the stars. And sitting outside and feeling the air as it cooled and hearing the sounds of the animals as they called to each other. So I went to college thinking I would be a lawyer, and then I switched to thinking I would be a medical doctor, and that's why I took organic chemistry, and absolutely fell in love with organic chemistry, in large part because of an incredible professor. And I remember driving one night with my college friends, and we were going to visit some other friends at a different town, and looking up and seeing the bright night sky and seeing molecules in the stars. So one of the ways that we draw molecules in chemistry is kind of letters that connect with lines, and they really look like constellations in some way. And that hit me like a ton of bricks at that moment. I was seeing the molecules that I had been drawing in class in the stars and feeling that scale of the molecular to the universal and feeling like this small part of this bigger thing and smaller thing. And so it was that crossing from the things that I couldn't see because they were so small to the things that I couldn't see because they were so vast felt really, really powerful in the moment.
You're reminding me of being a young scout in the bottom of the Grand Canyon, where just a day before I had been on the rim looking at the vastness of it, but then I'm down at the river looking just at a few pebbles.
Yes.
And realizing that somehow these things adhere to each other, the big and the small.
I love that. And I think that connectedness, that big and the small, not only are they both existing, but what you were experiencing too, the pebbles came from the rock. And so that connection between things and just feeling like this bit of stardust ourselves in those moments was really, really powerful. And most of my friends were like, why are you studying chemistry? To have that be providing these kind of profound experiences in the universe was really, really cool.
Did you feel a little like the odd person out, the odd man out?
I don't think any of my closest friends were doing any kind of science degree at all. And like I said, there are no scientists in my family.
Was that hard to be kind of on your own that way?
It wasn't. I kind of liked it, I think. I kind of enjoyed the challenge of taking what I was learning and forcing my friends and family to be excited about it. And I think that I never realized that before until that question, but I think that still plays out now to take things that it is easy for people not to see the beauty of or the wonder of and to try to find the ways to share it with them so that it hits them like a ton of bricks. When we first moved to Moab in the late 90s, I was waiting tables at the Moab Brewery and the coffee shop there. And so I was just exploring the out of doors on my own and didn't have any kind of formal introduction to biocrusts. The first biocrusts I saw were incredibly colorful. And so I think I had the opportunity to be shocked by them early on because there were so many pinks and greens and blacks and
whites. What were you expecting?
I think I didn't even know they existed.
It would be highly impolitic of me here to say that she stumbled on biocrusts, because once you know how fragile and vulnerable they are, you would be super careful not to stumble. Scientists and conservationists and rangers all advocate for their protection. It's not enough to just tread lightly. A person's a person, no matter how small. But as I was saying, Sasha Reed had an accidental encounter with these living organisms, discovering them quite by chance, and she was immediately hooked. Her fears as an East Coast girl out west, intimidated by desert wildness and solitude and vastness, those are in her rear view mirror. Red Rock Country ended up fitting her much better than she ever could have anticipated. There's a pivotal memory she has, kind of her baptism by sand, you could say. It's the moment she realized not only that she loved her new life in Western dry lands, but that she had what it takes to thrive there.
I was doing research as a technician with the U.S. Geological Survey, and I had to hike in and out of an area where I was going to collect some samples of soil and biocrust.
Yeah.
And many miles. I'm trying to remember if it was something on the order of an 18-mile day. And I started early in the morning when it was just getting light, and I ended in the dark. I had to hike with my headlamp a little bit. And I think that experience of overcoming my fear to be able to spend time outside by myself was transformative. I had this heavy backpack on filled with soils. I had made it all the way there, done my collections by myself, was walking back, beautiful canyons, incredible vistas around me. I'm carrying this heavy pack. I've covered all of these miles. I'm going to make it back by myself. I can handle this in a way that surprised me. And that shaped me somehow, and I felt so capable.
You're a novice sent to do field work to collect specimens for the lab. You're all alone for miles on end, from dawn till dusk. It's not suitable work for just anyone, particularly if you're not comfortable being alone with your own thoughts. There are TV survival shows about all of this, you know. I learned from Sasha Reed how the experience was not distressing or demoralizing for her. Quite the opposite, in fact.
I think this comes from how the West and my time outside has shaped me. But I feel drawn to open spaces that I can see a lot of nature around me. And I think I really like to feel small. I think life can be overwhelming for all of us at times, and we can feel intensely the stresses of our day-to-day life and the challenges that we face and things we have to deal with. Feeling small somehow makes those stresses feel less important to me. They're kind of seen in the context of a much larger world, and it makes me be like, all right, that's not that big a deal. I can handle that. It seems like from studying myself, I also am drawn to making myself a little bit afraid.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, you can make light of that and laugh all you want, but you benefit from putting yourself in situations where there's a little bit of fear that kicks in.
I seem drawn to it, yes. Like, I like to go to pretty remote places and to kind of push myself to experience adventures that in the moment I wonder what it is that I'm doing. So not adrenaline type adventures like jumping off of something or something like that, but more going to the middle of nowhere and trying to be out there with a handful of friends for a long time, maybe hiking a lot of miles, maybe climbing a mountain, doing something where the remoteness and the kind of scope of the trip make me feel a little bit nervous. I don't know if that's because I enjoy the release of surviving when we get back, or if it's similarly to the feeling small, it helps me put in perspective there are things to be worried about and you don't need to worry about this work thing. But I find myself a lot wondering, what am I doing right now? Why am I doing this? But I seem to keep doing it.
Is there a way to bridge from that experience of awe that comes from fear to doing the thing you said earlier on you want to do in the world?
Maybe part of what I enjoy about experiences where I have fear is seeing myself move through the fear, take action, and do what needs to be done, even in the face of being afraid. And I think that's what hope is, that even though we're not sure of the outcome and we're worried about the scale of the challenge, that we're able to take action and move forward, even if we're afraid. And so maybe that is what builds hope in me, is the confidence that I can move forward even when I'm afraid, even when things seem hard. And that's the hope that I want to share with other people, so that we together can move forward even if things are challenging in the moment.
The last time that played out for you with hope at the end, was it camping?
When I felt hopeful at the end and I made it through, yeah.
Where were you?
It was the last time that I really felt pushed. I was in southwestern Colorado on a long trip. The weather had been challenging. We were at very high elevation, but I was with people who helped me laugh and pushed me through. And at the end, we were really glad that we did it.
My boy and I, we went hiking a while back. It was the last time we could access the high mountains back here before a storm came in. And the storm came in while we were there, so we were trying to get out. And he's 14 years. He thought we were going to die.
Yeah. And so tell me how that played out.
I told him that we were not going to die. And I wasn't sure that we would survive. But we got back to the car. We were drenched and cold. And I was not near hypothermia, but I thought I could be there in 5 minutes. I'm a timid soul.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a thrill seeker.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be safe. I want to live. And yet in my memory, it was a good experience.
Yeah. So that's what I find really interesting. Is there, for you, when you think of it as a good situation and remembrance, is it because you lived? Is it because you have the ability to overcome?
I think it is for me, number one, that I survived. And that shows a kind of capability, but that capability I know was conjoint with foolishness. And so I have a certain element of shame. And I remember once becoming so dehydrated out in the slick rock above Moab on a bicycle where I didn't have enough water for the trip. And my tongue was sticking to the roof of my mouth. And I felt so foolish.
So I had to drink cooler water out of my car once because I was so dehydrated and just I had tried to break into another car where I saw a water bottle. And I know that feeling. I know exactly what you mean. But I don't want to be at the end of my life and not have had those experiences where I got pushed. I pushed myself. And some of it was my own, you know, decision making and things that I wouldn't do again in retrospect. But that you just feel alive, I think, both because you survived, you're not dead, but also because you were faced with a set of problems that had an uncertain outcome and you made it.
That was Sasha Reed in the first excerpt that we've lined up for you today in this sampler from early Constant Wonder episodes. Sasha Reed is a biogeochemist and ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Moab, Utah. By the way, you can enjoy the full episode featuring her here on Constant Wonder anytime. She was heard in Season 3, Episode 12. And I want to mention, if you're a parent of younger children, there's a Constant Wonder spinoff with short educational versions of many of our regular features produced for the grown-ups. Just look for Constant Wonder Kids wherever you get your podcasts. Your young kids will enjoy hearing Sasha Reed in this kid-friendly format. In just a moment, we'll hear from one of the more intrepid souls we have featured on Constant Wonder, and we've met many of those. Cassandra Quave will go just about anywhere on the globe, no matter how remote, so long as it offers her a deeper understanding of the plant-based medicines of indigenous cultures. Stay with us, because in Dr. Quave, you'll get to know yet another great heart and mind who, like so many of us, has an abiding commitment to the awe and wonder found in the world. In May of 2022, we produced an episode for Constant Wonder that explores the remarkable story and the professional work of Dr. Cassandra Quave. Quave is a preeminent researcher in the battle against infectious diseases and antibiotic resistance. This excerpt bypasses some details you're going to need to know about how she lost a leg while very young to a bout with serious infection. It's one of those heartbreaking instances in which a child undergoes surgery after surgery. You can hear about that chapter of her life when you listen to the full episode, but I mention it here briefly because as you listen to what follows, think about her passion for fighting infection and how this goes right back to her own daunting personal medical saga.
I also got very interested in visiting different communities, including communities that are a bit more off the beaten path, deeper into the tributaries, where you still had local people that spoke some of the native languages that were not so westernized yet. And it was in one of those villages where I met a Yagwa elder who was using the blowgun to hunt with. And it was just a really special moment, and he gifted it to me. And so I have it today in my office.
So was it just an artifact that he handed to you, or did you actually get to see that implement in use?
So when I was there in that village visiting and meeting with some of the women in this kind of palm thatch stilted hut, so they're up off the ground because of the seasonal flooding, we were talking about local plants and talking about traditions with medicine. And one of their husbands had come back from the forest with his catch for the evening to cook. And it was a large monkey that had a little baby monkey kind of clinging to it. And so there were a couple of things that were really interesting in that moment, because I saw the handoff of this juvenile monkey to the man's granddaughter. And often in these villages, young girls will take care of them as pets. And it's almost a way of kind of learning how to take care of younger siblings as they get older. And then eventually it becomes the family meal when it gets larger. He had just come back from a hunt. So I didn't see him actually kill the monkey, but, you know, yeah.
So what is it? What's it called? Curare?
Yeah. Yeah. There's this paralytic agent known as tubocurarine that's found in this plant, and other plants are mixed in this brew as well. And it's kind of like a little black tar that you dip the darts into. And what's amazing about it is when you hunt with something like that, you just barely have to prick the skin surface to get the effects. And so if you're hunting for, let's say dinner is a monkey in the rainforest canopy, it's a very quiet way of hunting. And this is a, you know, a method that indigenous peoples of the Amazon have used for millennia to acquire food through the use of this plant poison. It also, by the way, revolutionized surgery. If you go into the OR, you need to have your muscles in a relaxed state so that surgeons can do less damage when they're cutting in into your tissues. And so this really kind of was one of the kickstarters to the advances that we have today in modern anesthetics.
A blowgun dart with curare on its tip. Now, that's quite an image, and it raises a very interesting point, pun very much intended, because it's a point of considerable danger, namely this. Sometimes the line between plant poison and plant medicine can be very, very thin. But the same might be said about precision dosing using Western medicines, manufactured maybe by chemists in some high-tech lab. One of Cassandra Quave's epiphanies in Peru was her realization that traditional cultures often have, or once had, very sophisticated ways of using plants to do good rather than harm, and that Western interventions among indigenous peoples don't always make things better. In some cases, they make things worse.
This intersection between Western and traditional medicine has in some ways put local people at greater risk because Western medicine's been introduced, but it's vastly understocked. And so you might find some very, very basic medical kit ingredients in for a whole village in like a small medical kit, some Band-Aids, maybe some antiseptic, but they don't have access in many cases to the types of medicines they need. And unfortunately, because so much of this traditional knowledge has been displaced and lost as indigenous communities were, you know, pushed off of their native lands and pushed more and more towards these kind of main thoroughfares in the Amazon, which are the main rivers, they don't have that knowledge any longer of how to use many of these resources.
When ancient wisdom is lost, if that ancient wisdom really was a wise kind of wisdom to begin with, not foolish wisdom, well, that loss is potentially going to be considerable. And Cassandra had a firsthand chance to see and weigh such costs.
One of the things that I got really interested in was this maternal and child health. And on a lot of my travels through the different communities, kids were really curious that I was always surrounded by a passel of kids, like just so many children. And one thing that I noticed is that they would frequently drink water directly from the river. This is not water that's being boiled. And they're also barefoot. And through speaking with local healthcare providers, these kind of government-installed sanitarios, it was very clear that childhood morbidity from respiratory infections, from malaria, and kind of just chronic issues because of high load of intestinal parasites was a major problem. But from Don Antonio, what I'd learned was there's actually a fig tree that grows in many of these villages that was historically used to treat these infections. But because locals don't really know the information about the dosing and the safety, because it can really cause very severe stomach cramping and be dangerous if given to a child at the wrong dose or at the wrong level of disease severity, people didn't use it anymore. And so these kids were suffering from really high parasite loads and a number of other secondary health issues because of that. And when I came to understand that, that was one of the things that really helped me make that final decision eventually to pursue ethnobotany instead of medicine. Because during this time in the Amazon, I was still very much in the process of applying to medical school. And it wasn't until I'd had that experience and was really faced with that in the final moment of decision that I changed course.
Seeing the suffering, you mean?
Yeah, Yeah. And also seeing the potential of the plants that, that surround them, but yet aren't being studied by scientists, and the knowledge of their use or their historic use was being lost to the detriment of local public health.
So very often people in my shoes, with my experience, we will be guilty of calling the kinds of practices you saw in Peru, medical practices, we'd use the word primitive. I know that's condescending, but just play with me here for a bit. If the medicine that we know here in the first world is so advanced, is it really that far advanced? Is it a world apart from the kinds of practices, the therapies that
you saw there? It was just a different form of healthcare in a way. I think some of the bigger differences that did become immediately evident to me were the ways that I viewed medicine versus the ways that healers like Don Antonio viewed medicine. I had a very, let's say, black and white understanding. Medicine was always about just surgery and pharmacology. So pills or cut. That was basically medicine. And I was very skeptical in some ways of plant-based medicines. I mean, I was a pre-medical student at Emory, a double major in biology, anthropology, taking courses like biochemistry and organic chemistry and all those fun things that you do when you're preparing to go to medical school. And so I had a very, I think, pragmatic understanding of what medicine was. But what really happened, I think, for me during that experience was seeing that medicine was actually about much more than that. And that, in fact, the origins of modern day medicine, all those pills that many ways we take for granted today, that many of those actually had their origin stories in plants in places like the Amazon. Those were kind of some of the eye-opening points for me. And, you know, also just understanding the value of spirituality, the value of connectivity between people, between healers and patients, and also the value of connectivity between patients, healers, and nature, which are aspects that are perhaps harder to quantify, but nevertheless important when it comes to the practice of medicine.
If you're familiar with the work of ethnobotanical researchers such as Cassandra Quave, you may already have a sense for some of the resistance that these scientists sometimes encounter in the form of first world views of indigenous practices as primitive or backward or superstitious. Dr. Quave has a delightful way of dealing with that bias. She just sort of owns the disparaging language of naysayers by saying how much she herself is in love with witchy plants. To get her going in a discussion about these, I pulled up a direct quotation from one of the most engaging sections of her book, which is titled The Plant Hunter, A Scientist's Quest for Nature's Next Medicines. And the passage I read to her has to do with a traditional approach to treating a certain disease among an ethnic subgroup that lives in Italy but originates from Albania. These people, I learned from Dr. Quave, are known as the Arboretia.
Of all the things you've written, this passage, to me at least, it exemplifies just how exotic something can seem to me that makes perfect sense to somebody in another culture. And I want you to comment on this. This is actually in Italy. It has to do with a group of emigrants from Albania who've made their way to Italy. The Arboretia people, I think is how that's said. I'll just read some of this. This is just too good not to read. It has to do with something called the wind illness. The disease presents with small round inflammation of the skin, and the Arboretia believe that the patient contracts it when walking near places where someone has been murdered in the past. The healer's job is to first determine which malevolent spirit the patient encountered. This is important as the healing ceremony must use a weapon similar to that figured in the original crime, usually a knife, a pistol, or small axe. The weapon is then used to bless a glass of red wine that is mixed with gunpowder and then painted onto each of the inflammations in the form of a cross using a braided bundle of donkey tail hair. You know, that was, from my cultural perspective, and this says more about me maybe than anything else, that's so over the top.
It's difficult to sometimes explain, especially to kind of hardcore Western scientists that, you know, kind of see medicine as drug X hits target Y, right? I think there's value in documenting the details of a healing ceremony like that one, because you never know what what clues are going to emerge from such a description when you're actually trying to understand how a traditional medicine might work. In some cases, they're using different plants almost in like a symbolic form, but there is contact with the skin. In other cases, you know, within the field of dermatology, we know that there are plentiful examples of just self-resolving illnesses that after 3 cycles of 3 treatments, you know, you're looking at 9 days later, is the illness going to be gone or not? You know, sometimes these just self-resolve. But we also know from recent scientific studies on traditions such as meditation and compassionate-based meditation that you can observe lowered levels of inflammatory cytokines or kind of these kind of inflammatory markers in the body following these types of meditative practices. So what's at play here? Is the gunpowder and the red wine actually important to the scenario? I don't know. Is the braided bundle of donkey hair important? Who knows? It's probably just a brush in this. Or is it really the act of receiving that kind of healer-patient care with a lot of, you know, having that kind of meditative experience? When you are subjected to such a healing ceremony, I can say from my own personal experiences of receiving such ceremonies that there is a sense of relaxation and there's a sense of calm. You know, we just don't know enough yet about how these types of practices influence our immune system or influence our levels of inflammation and how that in turn might impact outcomes.
You've referenced that you yourself have been the recipient of such treatments. I'm wondering if you could describe those to us. There's one, at least, Don Antonio, that you tell fairly early on in your story, and I believe also in Italy. Could you describe those experiences and from your perspective?
Yeah, so with Don Antonio, he performed a healing bath ceremony, which basically involved a bowl of just water from the river, and it had some crushed mint herbs. So not like peppermint, but other species that are found in the Amazon that are in that kind of mint family that have a little bit of that aroma. So in his ceremony, it involved placement at the edge of the forest where you could hear the bird calls and the movement of animals in the overstory canopy. You had all those sensory elements of the forest and all the sounds and feels of the forest. You had the aroma of this bowl of mint water that was poured over you. You had the meditative experience from his whistle, which is kind of a rhythmic whistle that was accompanied by movement of something called a shakapa bundle. It's basically a bundle of leaves from the grass family that make a kind of a whooshing sound. So if you can picture, you're in this element in the forest and there's this constant whoosh, 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 almost like a heartbeat, and the whistling, the herb water, and the intention that he has to make you feel better. Now, I don't know how to quantify that yet from a laboratory perspective. Maybe this could be something, you know, that could be studied in the future of like, look at what's happening to the immune response pre and post some sort of intervention like that. But I can say from my own personal experience, it was very calming and very relaxing. And a lot of my troubles at that time were my indecision that I was feeling and anxiety I was feeling over my future path. And he made me feel better. And so, you know, it's important to note too that disabilities and challenges that I grew up with, you know, I'd never received as a child any sort of psychiatric care or counseling, which today I would think that that would be more of a standard of care. But when I was a child, it was not. And so this was in a way my first kind of psychological therapy I'd ever experienced, in addition to like the sensory aspects. And with Zia Elena in Italy, she performed a ceremony on my leg. My stump was inflamed and just not feeling well. And, you know, again, it was these symbolism, the repetition, the sounds. In her case, she was, you know, saying prayers in Italian in the Catholic tradition, and touch. So the soft touches to the damaged site. And so it may be difficult to explain these experiences from the perspective of biochemistry, but I can say from the perspective of psychological feeling, they were very helpful. I love witchy, magical, I'm doing quotation marks here, magical plants, because really, when you think about what is a magical plant or a witchy plant in a culture, it usually, in many cases, is a plant that has some really interesting chemistry. You can think about the example of the Madagascar periwinkle. That was very firmly put as a magical witch's plant. And we know today that the chemistry from that plant was actually useful in treating cancer. In fact, we have FDA-approved drugs from that plant that have healed countless patients of, you know, childhood leukemia, vincristine. So the yew tree is another example. You know, I'm an unabashed tree hugger. Like, if I see an ancient tree, I have to put my arms around it. It's just, there's just something about, I mean, because it's like, when do you get to touch a being that's been on this planet for centuries, if not millennia in some cases? And again, another plant that has a very rich history in myth and lore, and as we know today, is the source of another important anti-cancer drug, Taxol. So I'm not afraid of looking at witchy plants. I think witchy plants, that's often a clue that there's some interesting chemistry happening there.
Well, in your work with witchy plants and would-be witchy plants and near witchy plants, there is the Brazilian pepper tree. I grew up as a young boy loving to climb in our Southern California Brazilian pepper trees. And I remember so well walking across the hot summer sidewalk of concrete and smashing the little red pepper corns and smelling that pungent aroma. I did not know until recently, number one, that they're actually edible. They can be used as a spice. But in your research, you've had a great interest in this plant and other plants like this. And I'm going to try to describe what you do. You take either the seed or the leaf or the bark, and you extract the compounds from it. There's this thing called a rotary evaporator that I've seen on video before that happens where you, in some process, you either concentrate or extract this material, and then you subject like superbugs to it to see what happens. Did I get
that
right?
That's great. Yeah, you did. Absolutely. Yeah.
You like the pepper trees, the Brazilian pepper trees.
Well, it's, you know, again, it's one of those things that It's a noxious weed in Florida. People hate it in Florida. It's originally from Brazil, as the name kind of implies. But I'm also a fan of history, and I got interested in this plant. When you look back at historic records, going back to the 1600s in Brazil, there's evidence that it was used as poultices and to treat kind of ulcerated, non-healing wounds. And I get really... I get really interested in oozing pussy wounds because that, for me, is a clue that it's an important clue. Here's a plant that people are using to treat an active infection. Is that a logical place to look for a potential new drug? Absolutely. And with the pepper tree, the story that it's told us, I mean, has just been fascinating because from the fruits, which are used as a kind of poultice to treat these skin infections, it doesn't actually kill the bacteria like a normal antibiotic. So some might look at that and say, well, this is not a useful remedy. This is an old wives' tale that has no value. But instead, I really try and push my research team to ask more questions. What else might this plant teach us? And in this case, we found that while it does not inhibit the growth like an antibiotic of the bacteria, what it does do is it changes the bacteria's behavior. It forces them to behave as if they're on their own as individual cells. And guess what? When they behave like they're alone rather than a group, they produce less toxins. And so here you have a scenario where you can have the cells alive, but they basically have been weakened. They're no longer able to deploy all of those weapons that destroy our tissue and create those big, pussy, non-healing wounds.
You've kind of quarantined the individual cells so they can't work in concert with each other.
Exactly. Yeah. It's taking out their communication system. You know, I think there's so many stories like that where plants that have been used historically and continue to be used today, but which perhaps fail in some of our modern high-tech laboratory tests, I don't necessarily rule those out because I think we don't even have all the right questions today. And there are lots of other ways that we could ask questions of these plants. And a lot of the antimicrobial standard tests, it's usually just looking again at whether you can kill the bacteria or not. But what about what's happening to the immune system? What about what's happening to these other defense systems that the bacteria have?
It's a much more holistic approach. You're thinking outside the usual box.
Yeah. I mean, I like to tell my students there is no box. The moment you start to think within the context of a box, and the box in this case being that an antibiotic must be this, then you really are starting to limit yourself. I try and keep a very open mind and thinking, what can we learn from these traditions? Because, you know, from a healer's perspective, they're most concerned with healing the patient. Like, what's the overall final outcome? They're not concerned about, you know, concentrations to kill the bacteria. They're not thinking about bacteria at all. They're thinking about, how do I heal my patient?
Dr. Cassandra Quave is author of The Plant Hunter, A Scientist's Quest for Nature's Next Medicines. She's very active these days on Substack as a science educator. Her Substack is called Nature's Pharmacy. When you check that out, you'll find incredibly engaging information not just about superbugs, but about countless other facets of nature's power to heal. And again, what you've just listened to was an extended excerpt of the full exchange I had on Constant Wonder with Cassandra Quave. You can enjoy the whole thing on whatever podcast platform you use. Just look it up. It's Season 2, Episode 15 of Constant Wonder. Our final excerpt in today's sampler of highlights from the Constant Wonder podcast will acquaint you with naturalist Lyanda Lynn Haupt, who took in an animal that few of us would ever even consider as a candidate for a housemate. She made a small starling part of her own family, following in the footsteps of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, who had done the same. When he wasn't composing, he was taking care of a bird. We're not going to introduce you to the starling here, but you will get to meet Lyanda, who will leave you with an appetite for the full episode we had with her, including the starling story. I'm Marcus Smith. Thanks for listening. Lyanda Lynn Haupt is an acclaimed American naturalist and eco-philosopher who inspires people to explore the connection between us humans and other living things. In her books, she weaves together science and history with autobiographical vignettes that foster deeper awareness of worlds both large and small. She's often at her very best when she's promoting a deep sense of wonder by opening her reader's eyes to the astonishing natural phenomena often found right outside the door. This is a common theme on our podcasts, and it's one that can't be emphasized nearly enough. For our sampler, I have chosen an excerpt from my conversation with Lyanda that concerns a famous prehistoric human settlement in Ireland. Actually, I should say, it has to do with a grand circular monument that these people left behind. Constant Wonder casts a broad net, and we include topics from the arts, the sciences, from history and nature. We will go wherever the quest for awe and wonder of a transformative kind might lead us. And Lyanda reports that her visit to Newgrange in Ireland, this monument I just mentioned, technically called a passage tomb, well, that experience was absolutely life-changing for her. I'd like to talk with you now for a little bit about a super memorable experience you had. This was in a place that was both earthy and unearthly. And it happens to involve putting your skin directly on soil. That's a thing you advocate for frequently, barefootedness, along with wandering and solo wilderness, and sometimes maybe being in moccasins, I guess. But it seems that your preference is to get as close as you can to the earth. One of the most wondrous, most awe-inspiring moments, by your own admission, in your whole life, was in Ireland, and you took your shoes off there. Would you take us to that anciently constructed mound in Ireland made out of heaped up earth and stone, the place called Newgrange?
So Newgrange is this huge, circular, low to the ground, stone, megalithic site with graves in the interior. And I was so blessed to be there on a day that the sun was shining. So I was able to take off my shoes and walk the perimeter of the structure, incredible stone structure. And when I went into the interior, which you can only do with a guide, and I was a little bit worried, you know, some guides can be really chatty or they can just make lots of jokes and make your encounter with a deeply sacred place like that lose some of its weight. But again, I was blessed to have a wonderful guide. There were only about 10 of us allowed in at a time. And she prepared us to look at the very essential designs. We don't know what the purpose or the meaning of these etchings were, but there are these beautiful designs etched into the stone. They're spirals, zigzags, some triangles, some arrow-like symbols. And she, while telling us to be sure not to touch them with our hands, invited us to contemplate their meaning, but also said, and this was really significant to me, she guarded us against imposing our own sense of meaning or our own interpretation upon them. So we were allowed to take our shoes off before we went in. And there's a long, dark tunnel that leads you into a smaller, very cool, very dark space within. And she guided us there with her flashlight. We were not allowed to have our phones on or anything like that, any artificial light or sound. She guided us in with her flashlight while giving us just enough information. She was so respectful of the silence and sacredness of that place. And she turned off the flashlight and let us just dwell there in the darkness. And then she had some little switch that would activate a light that was outside that would show us how the interior temple would look. I call it a temple. The interior space would look on the winter solstice, because like many of these beautiful ancient megalithic sites, it was oriented to astronomical events and to the seasons. And Newgrange is especially known for having this shaft of light shine right into the interior on the winter solstice. So I'm there with my bare feet. I'm there with all of these incredible etchings and the knowledge that they were 5,000 years old. And I could somehow feel just this whispering, visceral presence of women that had gone before me in this place, birthing, laughing, grieving, dying, burying their children, their mothers. And I got really nauseous. It's so much spinning in my head that affected my stomach. And it just felt kind of dizzy and nauseating, but in a way that made it also feel very real and important. I learned that the people that lived there likely measured the places that they were constructing with their feet, with their steps. These places were measured step by step, foot by foot, with bare feet. And I loved that idea that we are present to a place through that connection, the foot to earth. We make sense of that connection by our sense of touch, but our measurement foot comes from the human foot, right? So also that idea of locating our space or orienting ourselves in space from very ancient times by the measure of our footfalls.
There was a time in the life of Lyanda when she was just a little girl, and her idea of beauty in nature before she became certified as a naturalist, your innocence of youth put you in a place that you called the Stream of Sparkling Stones. That was not its real name. Where was that exactly?
So I grew up in Kent, which is a town outside of Seattle. And in my backyard, there was a kind of a wooded ravine or a canyon. And in the bottom of that canyon, there was a stream. And it was actually called Mill Creek. I'm assuming sometime in history, there must have been a mill. There's a lot of Mill Creeks in our nation. But I spent a lot of time down there, and I would just bring my sketchbook. I love to draw and write, bring an apple, and just hang out down there, just out of reach of my mom calling me for dinner, plausibly. I could probably hear her, and if I was hungry, I would hear her, and if I wanted to stay. I had plausible deniability. Couldn't quite.
And about how old are you at this time?
About 10, you know, in that region of life, 8 to 12, several years of my life that I was spending down, taking some solitude by the stream. I did have friends too. I don't want to sound like a super totally weird introvert. I loved to go hiking with my friends. I loved hanging out with my friends when I was young, but I also have that introvert's need for solitude. And
well, the reason I bring this particular venue up from early on in your life is because this is at a time when maybe you had a fairly naive view of how everything about nature would just be sweetness and light and wonderful and harmless. And you were attending church at that stream, I understand, an informal church.
Yeah, I would go and hang out by the stream, and I started to see the frogs in the stream, because there were a lot more frogs than there are now back then. And I started to see them as my congregation. And I would just eventually kind of lie on my back there in sort of the muddy stream side. And you could enter, you know, even as a child, we enter into these sort of medial states of consciousness where, you know, the leaves are kind of twinkling overhead and there's dappled sunlight between them reaching to the forest or the woodland floor. And the frogs were so close. You know how they do that thing where they're just sort of suspended in the water with just their eyes over the top of the water? And what I learned is that I could reach behind them with my hand and just sort of slowly, slowly lift them up. I didn't know then what I know now, which is that frogs have very, very good eyesight. They have actually the best night vision of any animal on Earth. So they could see, and they also see things that move quickly, most readily, because they're looking for prey. So they're not as attuned to things moving really slowly. And although I didn't know that then, I learned by experimentation that if I just slowly slipped my hand under them and lifted slowly from beneath, that they would just rest quietly on my palm. And I could feel that strange breathing they have with those kind of round, cool bellies. And I would transfer them to my own belly. So I'm lying on my back by the stream, scooping up frogs, putting them on my belly, sort of having this moment of childhood prayer, being a kind of weird spiritual kid in the woods. And I started to think of it as my church, my frog church.
Quite obviously, this frog church is a prime example of being maximally present to the world. That was Lyandalyn Haupt, and she can be heard in a full episode of Constant Wonder. Look for Season 4, Episode 7. It's titled Fear and Wonder in the Natural World. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe to Constant Wonder and reach out to us anytime with comments and observations about the material we bring you. We also love hearing about your own moments of transformative awe and wonder in this world. You can reach us by email, constantwonder@byu.edu. I'm Marcus Smith. Thanks for listening.